This is the third day of this April 2017 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text the last 2 days, a book called Mud and Water, a collection of talks by the 14th century Japanese Zen master Basui, translated by Arthur Braverman. This is in the form of questions and answers. Questioner, even if one practices the way, if he doesn't know how to read one word, surely he will enter the evil path. For example, though he were to attain enlightenment, without wisdom he could not save people. There are those who say one should practice meditating on mind after studying the sutras. Then there are those who say extensive knowledge and broad studies are the many particles of dust of delusion which form the seeds of interference to enlightenment. Which of these two statements should I believe? Basui, enlightenment is one's inherent nature. This inherent nature is Buddha. Buddha is the way, and the way is wisdom. Let me just repeat that first phrase. Enlightenment is one's inherent nature. Everyone possesses this wisdom. It gives each individual perfect harmony. It is the natural beauty of the true ground and original face of all Buddhas and ordinary people. Awakening to this depends only on your aspiration. It makes no difference whether you can read or not. Even if, for example, one cannot remember his own name, and being a man of inferior roots cannot read at all, if he believes this principle, he is considered one of superior roots. One who sees into his own nature arouses the great wisdom for which there is no teacher. Penetrates the ashes of the Buddhas and the patriarchs, and in an instant realizes the principal Dharma teaching of the 1,000 distinctions and 10,000 divisions, the teachings of the scholars of the 100 houses, and the causes for birth as gods and humans. What could be hidden from him? So these allusions, the Dharma teaching of the 1,000 distinctions and 10,000 divisions, teachings of the scholars of the 100 houses. This is nothing that, there's a footnote, but it's nothing that we need to be concerned about. It's all about study. Even if, for example, one studies the teachings of the 8 sects, these are the some 8 Japanese sects, and the 3 schools, or performs wonderful miracles, compared with the original wisdom, it is like a solitary light under the sun, or worse, like comparing a firefly to the light of the moon. There's a koan in the Mumonkan, number 28, where it describes the great enlightenment of Master Deshan or Toksan, and he had been a great scholar, particularly of the Diamond Sutra. He became known as the great expert on the Diamond Sutra, and he went around with his sutras on his back, traveling around, showing up everyone who thought they knew about the Diamond Sutra. And then he ran into a Zen master, and after long discussion deep into the night, the Toksan, Deshan, said he had to leave, and he was about to exit, and He said, it's dark outside, and the master, Lung Tan, lit a candle, and as he handed the candle to Toksan in the near dark, just as Toksan was about to take it, Lung Tan blew out the candle. And at that, Toksan came to deep enlightenment. And he, at the time, he said, even the many mysterious teachings I have studied are like a strand of hair in the open sky. Even if one masters all the essential knowledge in the world, it is like throwing a drop of water into a deep ravine. And with that, he burned all his commentaries. This is the distinction between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is about acquiring. Knowledge is analytical. It's discursive understanding. Whereas wisdom is our birthright. We are all endowed with this wisdom. Every single one of us has it in equal measure. So we just have to awaken to it. This reference to the three schools is to Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. And scholars say that it's the Zen, or Chan, to use the Chinese word, Chan was an amalgam of Confucianism and Taoism with Indian Buddhism. Be skipping around a lot today. There's a lot of material here that isn't suited for reading aloud. But here's a questioner who asks, there is not one among the good teachers from ancient times up to the present who hasn't said that there is no Buddha existing outside of the mind. Though it is clear from this that all phenomena are delusion, I am not able to let go of the belief in the existence of phenomena. It is a belief in the world of things, and the belief that there is just this world of things and that they are real in every sense of the word. He still clings to that belief. Whereas in Awakening reveals that this world of things, of phenomena, is really, ultimately, no thing. Then he says, is this a result of lingering habits from my mind? Well, the short answer is yes. It's conditioning. It's deep conditioning from lifetimes of getting caught in the world of things and coming to become attached to them. But Basui says, you are unable to dismiss lingering habits simply because you are not looking into your own nature. If you clearly penetrate this truth of seeing into your own nature, arousing the great Prajna wisdom, and realizing that all names and forms are illusion, you will never again have feelings of attachment to either existence or emptiness. Hence it is said in a sutra, called the Sutra on Perfect Enlightenment, when you know it as illusion, you are at that moment detached from it and have no need for any expedient means. And then Basui continues, if you try to remove lingering habits that come from attachment to form, not yet having seen into your own nature, you are like one in deep sleep trying to rid himself of a dream. The desire to rid oneself of it is itself a dream. The knowledge that it is a dream is also nothing but a dream. And as for completely waking up from this sleep, no matter how much you seek something within a dream, you will never attain it. The Buddha said, all karmic paths are like dreams, illusions, bubbles, and shadows. They are like a dewdrop or a flash of lightning. Thus shall you think of it. So this statement, if you try to remove lingering habits that come from attachment to form, but without having seen into your own nature, this is futile. It is seeing into our true nature that reveals the emptiness of our attachments, which is a start. The attachments do linger after awakening. They can linger a long time, but at least having seen them as illusory in the deepest sense, then we stand on much better ground as a way to let go of them. It enables us to more easily refrain from going into our attachments, especially our mental attachments. He continues, Bodhidharma is the living patriarch who harmonized the four elements. This old master single-handedly transmitted the mind seal. He pointed directly to people's minds, showing them that seeing their own nature is Buddhahood. He based his teaching neither on words nor on forms. And though the Buddhas of past, present, and future and the historical patriarchs all appear in the form of living beings, not one physical body remains. They all perish. Only a word or a phrase remains in this world. Of the words they leave behind, none testifies to the reality of form. They even refute the views of emptiness and nothingness. Let me just try to explain that once again. These are the two sides of reality. There's the side of form, of phenomena, in which we can say that, yes, a cushion exists. A bird exists. Trees exist. We can say that, but it's only half the truth. The other half is that in their essential nature, in essence, there isn't anything that lasts from moment to moment. In that sense, we say they don't exist. So the existence and non-existence are the two halves of reality. And if we get caught in either one, that also means emptiness, no thingness, then we go astray. Again, referring to the Buddhas and patriarchs, they even refute the views of emptiness and nothingness. If it is said that there were Buddhas and patriarchs who based their teaching on existence, this is completely false. What other kinds of living Buddhas and patriarchs do you believe in? If you believe in the painted and sculptured images of the ancient Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, You shouldn't say you believe in living Buddhas, but rather that you simply believe in gold, silver, copper, iron, wood, rock, silk paper, modeling clay, and the like. These paintings and sculptured images of Buddhas are all the workings of people's minds. Wooden Buddhas have never made people. What you have to realize is that mind is the mother and father of all Buddhas, the master of the 10,000 things. So what any Buddha figure is doing at its best is it just is a form. The closest we can come to representing our true mind, our true self, in form. Our true self is without form. But without these images, figures, it would all be seem so abstract. And so someone came up with this a long, long time ago as a way to remind us of our true nature. Hakuin said, in reality, Buddhas have no form. They are given form out of our necessity. It's a concession, in a way. It's a concession to our very human needs, our human need to relate to something, a form, rather than just abstraction. I guess in Islam, images of any kind are seen as wrong, bad. But what then lends itself to the kind of abstraction, abstract thinking that enables you to conceptualize an enemy, an other, and then go from there. He continues, though the mind of ordinary people is clear and one with the Buddhas and patriarchs, unable to believe it, you fail to rid yourself of attachment to form. Therefore, you transmigrate through the six realms, binding yourself and enduring pain. Suppose, for example, you were to arouse your aspiration and perform severe ascetic practices. If you desire to harmonize yourself with a path of no mind, while still harboring feelings of attachment to form, it would be like starting a fire by striking a rock at the bottom of the ocean. Though it is a rock at the bottom of the ocean, if you take it, put it on land, and then strike it, you will immediately produce a flame. Though every rock is equipped with the nature of fire, as long as it is submerged in water, it cannot give rise to flames. The same way, all people are equipped with the inclination to spiritual awakening, yet without removing the feeling of attachment to all form, they cannot give rise to this awakening. Do you see why it is said, though Buddha nature manifests itself magnificently, those who have feelings of attachment to form cannot see it? Just say a bit more about this attachment to form, which he has been repeating here. Attachment to form also means mental forms, thoughts, thought forms. This is the most treacherous attachment. It's not just to cigarettes or food or whatever. It's attachment to our thoughts. questioner. It is said that when looking at the sayings and teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs, if you look at them as one with fresh hatred looks upon an enemy, you will then, for the first time, be able to understand them. What do you think about this saying? So this phrase, looking at these sayings of the Buddha and the Buddhist text, looking at them with the same kind of fresh hatred that one looks upon an enemy, it means, of course, regarding the words of the Buddhas and other teachers with this fierce, unwavering attention and determination. Basui, the way is a fundamental part of everybody. Its essence is to penetrate enlightenment and to leave no trace of this attainment. If I were to explain this fundamental part, even the one word awaken would add waves to a level surface. How much more so with sayings and teachings? One who holds on to the residue and cannot grasp the real cuts himself off from the source in the end. So this is a classic Zen wariness of words and how words can deceive us and how easily we become attached to words and sayings. This is the warning. He continues, Buddha nature, the self of all beings, is the simple truth as it is. It transcends sects and rules. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds, past, present, and future, can't explain it. The commentaries on the treasury of the teachings discussed during the lifetime of the Buddha can't catch hold of it either. Its full function has no equal. The speed of a flint spark can't compare with it. Lightning can't even penetrate it. Its activity has no fixed direction. Thinking it is rising in the east, it sinks in the west. Thinking it is rising in the south, it sinks in the north. It makes thunder roar in clear, fine weather, and flames arise at the bottom of the sea. So the functioning of this nature of ours, this Buddha nature, this Dharma nature, is beyond anything we can comprehend with our ordinary minds. It is incomprehensible. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds, all of the most enlightened people of all time, can't explain it. He continues, it is the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving, and the master that raises the hands and propels the legs. From the Buddhas and patriarchs down to insects, of all things that possess essential nature, who would not receive its favor? What of you people? Do you know yourselves? When you doubt sufficiently, that is question, your enlightenment will be sufficient. When you have true aspiration, even if you don't want to doubt, your whole body will be filled with doubt. Even if you don't seek expedient practices, your mind will not busy itself with miscellany. Though you don't want to eliminate them, you will be rid of the 10,000 things. Though you don't choose to discard them, reading sutras and commentaries and all kinds of activities will naturally be eliminated. Profit and loss, good and bad, all will be obliterated. Like one who is stricken with a severe illness and is about to die, whose mind doesn't distinguish friends from enemies. When you travel, you will forget you are walking. When you are eating, you will be unaware of the taste. When you are sitting, you will forget you are sitting. Forgetting your body, you will not lie down. If in this way you become a part of this doubt, in a short time you will inevitably experience great enlightenment. Now, he's talking here about the most powerful, deepest kind of questioning of one's koan or question, to a point of no-mindedness. And here's where we have to acknowledge there is a difference between no-mindedness and mindfulness. And if we were mindfully eating, we would not, as he said, when you're eating, not tasting the food. If we're mindfully traveling, we'd be aware that we're walking. When mindfully sitting, we're aware that we're sitting. But this is the realm of great doubt, where we lose ourselves. And both mindfulness and no-mindedness are great states to cultivate, but it is, one is more likely to come to awakening through this no-mindedness, of completely losing oneself, losing the self. When he says, when you have true aspiration, even if you didn't want to doubt, even if you, just to be silly, even if you didn't want to be questioning, your whole body would be filled with questioning. In other words, it takes over you. It possesses us. This is a temporary state. People often ask, well, why would I want to, when eating, not be aware that I'm eating? Or, as they say in, there's a saying from ancient China, when one who is working on Mu, when one is in this great doubt, when he doesn't see the sky when he raises his head, nor the ground when he lowers his head. And those who have a fixed idea about how we want to be mindful and aware as the ultimate reach of meditation will be confused by that. And rightfully so. The great doubt, the state of losing oneself and losing awareness of eating while eating or walking while walking, this is all for the purpose of breaking through into a state then, which isn't a state, breaking through beyond this doubt mass into a state of bright, wakeful awareness. So it is a temporary state, but one that is charged with possibility, the possibility of awakening to our true nature. He's describing a very advanced state, where when you're eating, you're not aware, you're so lost in the questioning that you aren't even aware that you're eating, and so forth with the other activities. The worst thing anyone could do now is hearing this, is to start to measure one's concentration in this way. Oh, I'm aware I'm eating. Oh, I guess I'm not there yet. I did that for a while. It's so counterproductive. The whole point of this is to get you to forget about how you're doing and just lose yourself in the questioning of the practice. And then he ends, if in this way you become a part of this doubt, this questioning, In a short time, you will inevitably experience great enlightenment. I'm reminded of a true story. One of my students many years ago was at home with his wife and their two kids, and actually this came from her, this story. She was in the kitchen and he came in with the daughter, holding the daughter on his hip, and in alarm said, "Where is, let's call her Anna," that was the girl's name, who was sitting in his arms. "Where is she?" You know, he had apparently looked and looked for her. She looked at him, of course, like he was out of his mind, and pointed to the little girl he was holding. It's like that legendary story of Enyadatta suddenly waking up one morning and thinking that she'd lost her head and running around asking everyone, "Where's my head? Where's my head?" until someone clouted her in the head and she realized that it had always been there. And then he quotes an ancient, let's see if who that would be, footnote. Oh, a Sozan Honjaku. Okay. "An ancient said, 'To care for this matter as your own, be like one who, passing through a village which has been infected with destructive rice worms, will not even wet his throat with a drop of water. Then you will attain it.'" And then Basui elaborates, "Thus, if you want enlightenment, abandon to its depths all ordinary attachment to deeds and behavior, principles and obligations, opinions and interpretations." In other words, let go of everything. "Be as before the birth of your mother and father, separate from all external phenomena, neither sinking into internal quiet nor settling in the void. Look directly. Now, as you are listening, tell me, what is it that listens?" What is it that listens? What is it that's hearing these words? He's describing here a state, abandon all attachment to what we're doing and behavior, our conduct, our principles. Principles are ideas. Let go of obligations. Certainly opinions, let go of it all. Actually, to be precise, in absorption in the koan we're working on, these things are, they disappear on their own. We don't have to make a project out of letting go of them. Through absorption in the practice we're working on, these things evaporate. All of these mental forms. It's a very important point. Let me repeat it. We don't have to go about making a project out of getting rid of our thoughts, any kind of thoughts, our attachments, our mental attachments. But instead, through this sheer concentration on the practice, those things will dissolve on their own. Find out for yourself. Do this. This last question he threw out, what is it that listens? And then he quotes Rinzai, or Linchi, this physical body of yours, composed of the four great elements, can't hear the Dharma. Your spleen, stomach, liver, and gallbladder can't hear the Dharma. The empty sky can't hear the Dharma. Then what does hear it? Just let go from the overhanging cliff and investigate thoroughly. Questioner, I hear that all these successive ancestors point directly to people's minds, causing them to look into their inherent nature and attain Buddhahood. I also hear that looking at one's self is as intense as hatred for an enemy. What is the meaning of this? And then Basui, in the self there are the true and the false. The conscious mind is the false. Buddha nature is the true. Now, let me just say, I think in this, his reference to the conscious mind is his way of translating this discursive mind, the discriminating mind, this little segment of our true mind that analyzes and discriminates. The conscious mind is the false. Buddha nature is the true. When you awaken to your true nature, you cut off the roots of the wheel of transmigration, let's say the wheel of life and death. Manifest your many inherent virtues and make contact with others, bringing benefit to their lives. This is seeing into your inherent nature and attaining Buddhahood. The root of life and death is the conscious mind. Beginning practitioners mistakenly take things like the emission of light and the performance of miracles, which are really the roots of ignorance, for the clear expression of Buddha nature. An ancient said, students of the way don't realize the truth because they dwell on the conscious mind of the past. The seed of birth and death through endless eons is what fools call the true original self. So, back to this, what he's calling the conscious mind, the discriminating mind. It's that which divides reality. It divides time into past and future and present and hours and days and years. It's that which creates the notion of time and space. It's that which knows only the world of change and differences. But then there is this other aspect, the world of the undifferentiated, that is beyond time, beyond space, beyond discrimination, beyond right and wrong and good and bad. He goes on, referring to the conscious mind. I suppose you could also, maybe another translator would have translated this as the ego. The conscious mind, ego is not a better translation. The mind, small m mind is what it's all about. This conscious mind is the boss of notorious robbers, the origin of the 10 evil deeds, and the pit of knowledge based on attachment to form. If it is not destroyed, though you were to speak wonderful words of the miraculous, they would all be no more than the strange spirits of wild foxes. In the end, you wouldn't be able to avoid floating in the world of rebirth. That's why its destruction is connected with the one great matter. Well, when he says destruction, it really means seeing through. We don't have to destroy this discriminating mind. He means to see beyond it, to see what's underneath it, what's behind it, to see our true mind. That's why its destruction is connected with the one great matter. I think we better stop here and we'll resume tomorrow. We'll now recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gates beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gates beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gates beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain.